Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. There are loads of books written on war, from military strategy to history, novels, and so much more. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times, join us with their selections on the subject of war. And I know this was a tough one because there is so much to choose from.
As I was saying earlier to you, that you could have done a show just on war novels. You could have done something on war poetry, on war photography, on memoirs of war. It's endless. You could pick one war and do a whole show just on one war.
I was stunned when I went looking for books. Because then I had to, you know, rapidly sort of shape in my own mind how constructing an hour of conversation. How many areas do you want to run into? You know, and I thought, but as usual, I went for the things that were a little bit outside the center. Those are the ones that excite me. And even in terms of fiction, which I didn't even bring any fiction, part of the reason was when I Googled, of course, great war books, 377 came up on Goodreads alone. Mm-hmm. And in trolling down the list, I realized I read about half of them and I thought, you know these books. Right. And they're a big part of different aspects of your life, which I think we're going to talk about too, one of the novels that Jill brought. And so you don't need to drag them all along with you, with the wheelbarrow.
They're in the memory bank. Yeah.
They're in the memory bank. So.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's start with... this is kind of a war of a different sort.
Fictional war. This is a fictional war.
This is a fictional war. This is the anniversary of the War of the Worlds. Was that 1938?
It was. And yes, we are on actually the day.
Oh, today. See?
Today is, in fact, the 75th anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast. So I thought we should at least mention this.
Oh,
and
for sure.
As I was thinking about it, because there, in fact, is a kid's book on this very broadcast called Aliens Are Coming by Megan McCarthy, the true account of the 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast, which is a great little picture book and really tells kids about the basic things about what happened, and also introduces them to this concept that people were getting news through the radio and only the radio.
They're like, what?
There was none, yeah. What would that be? But in doing this, one of the things that I found was this great book on our library shelf called The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic, with the complete script of the famous Orson Welles broadcast by Hadley Cantrill. This was published in 1940, so only a couple years after this panic, by Princeton University Press. I was amazed it was still on our shelf, but there it was. And it talks about first of all, it has the script. So let me just give you a little sampling of this script. And when you hear this, you'll think, now, why would people believe this? First of all, it also is, they do right at the beginning, they're very clear, it's a radio play. But if you miss that first part, so here's a little sampling. Good heavens, something's wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another. They look like tentacles to me. There, I can see the thing's body. It's large as a bear and it glistens like wet leather. But that face, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. The eyes are black and gleam like a serpent. The mouth is V-shaped with saliva dripping from its rimless lips that seem to quiver and pulsate. The monster, or whatever it is, can hardly move. It seems weighed down by, possibly, gravity or something. Anyway, so, you know, you read this and you're like, how could anyone believe this? But one of the things they did, this group from that were studying this event, they went and talked to people. They talked to people both who believed the story and who didn't believe it. Now, mind you, many of the people who did not believe it had heard the beginning. They knew it was a radio play. But here's a great quote from somebody who believed that this was happening. I knew it was something terrible, and I was frightened, said Mrs. Ferguson, a northern New Jersey housewife, to the inquiring interviewer. But I didn't know just what it was. I couldn't make myself believe it was the end of the world. I've always heard that when the world would come to an end, it would come so fast nobody would know. So why should God get in touch with this announcer? When they told us what road to take and get up over the hills and the children began to cry, the family decided to go out. We took blankets and my granddaughter wanted to take the cat and the canary. We were outside the garage when the neighbor's boy came back and told us it was a play. So it's really an interesting read. And it also talks a lot about the importance of radio and how important radio was. They have this
still
whole
is.
Section.
Still, excuse me.
Radio as accepted vehicle for important announcements. The first wide use of radio in the country was to broadcast election returns. Since that time, important announcements of local, national, and international significance have been repeatedly made. A few short weeks before this broadcast, millions of listeners had kept their radios tuned for the latest news from a Europe apparently about to go to war.
So people were into their radio,
and they just believed it. And again, if you had missed that initial announcement.
And Melanie, you saw the American Experience has a War of the Worlds TV special. It was on last night, and I'm mad I missed that.
It was really good.
But you said they weren't allowed to use the word, what, flash?
There was quite a brouhaha after the event because some people were hurt.
Right.
In fact, apparently a couple people were killed in their panic to get away. And so there were congressional hearings and FCC hearings and things like that. And, of course, in the center of it was Orson Welles, who was only 23 years old at the time.
Wasn't that amazing? That was amazing. Yes.
23 years old at the time. And they had practiced how they were going to vocalize this play on the air. They had actually had rehearsals and things like that. But the outcome, one of the rules that was then put in place was that you could not use the words flash or bulletin unless it being real.
Real was real.
You couldn't use it as any part of a fictional, you know, approach on radio because people were told if you hear those words, they had been conditioned already. If you hear those words, it's a breaking news event.
Yeah.
Same way as if CNN was caught using the breaking news thing over nothing, you know.
Exactly.
There would be some kind of sanction on that because now we're conditioned to see the words breaking news.
The little bulletin that we hear when we have the emergency broadcast.
We're conditioned to that.
Exactly. Well, American Experience does it on Channel 44 at WGBX this afternoon at 2:30, tomorrow at 5 a.m. Might want to set the recorder for that. And on GBH Kids, Friday at 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Okay, weird schedule.
GBH Kids?
Yeah, I don't know. Dan looked that up for us. So. All right, we are talking about what books on war, 866-999-4626. If you have some suggestions for our list this morning, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, let's start with history. You both brought some things on history.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, let's start out by saying that next year marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One. And I think this event is going to get a huge amount of attention because I think it's one of these situations where it has been set aside by the events of World War II and all the wars that came, you know, in around it. But the beginning of the 20th century is World War One. It changes everything. It restructures Europe in a way that, in fact, up until the last few years ago, we were still dealing with the collapse of empires, the shifting of who sits on the throne or who sits in the chancellor's seat, the prime minister's seat. All of this changes during World War One, which is 1914 to 1918. And the United States goes into the war in 1917. But from 1914 to 1917, this is a clash of European civilization. Germans and Serbs against Russians, French, British, Belgians, and, you know, anyone else who wanted to throw some troops in. And so there's some wonderful books coming out on the topic. And I actually walked into a bookstore a couple weeks ago and saw a book called Catastrophe 1914, Europe Goes to War. And the reason it caught my attention is because it's by Max Hastings, who's a British historian of big note. Everyone knows Max Hastings. I've read a number of his books on World War II, and they're highly readable. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to learn anything about World War I and I don't know enough, Max Hastings is going to be the person who teaches me about this. And this is absolutely brand new. He's penned more than 20 books on history and warfare. He began as a foreign correspondent with the BBC. And his previous books include things like Das Reich, Armageddon, the Battle for Germany, 1944-45, and Inferno, Inferno, The World at War, 1939 to 1945. And he actually has another new book out called Bomber Command. If you're interested in the bomber commands of Europe during World War II, this is the guy to read. But the interesting thing about this book is that he is able to take the large spread of history, the maps, the movement of troops, that kind of thing, and to include hundreds and hundreds of anecdotes culled from letters, culled from meeting minutes, that kind of thing. And he begins early on. So we really get a strong sense of how this thing happened and what a mess. If you think World War II is a mess, World War I is worse, because there are people who want to go to war, and they want to go to war for the absolute worst reasons. And they actually have the power to send millions and millions and millions upon millions of men from England, from France, from Germany, from Russia, from the Baltic states, directly onto the battlefield with almost no preparation. So they begin talking about sort of the heat of war in the spring. And by August 1st, they're on the battlefields and they are clueless. And the death tolls rise more rapidly than any contemporary person would imagine. So when he uses the word catastrophe, he really means it. It is an unmitigated catastrophe. And he's got this wonderful opening about Winston Churchill, who had already been in the Boer War and was itching to get back into war. If anything, Churchill was a military person, even though he ended up in politics. And he writes in the introduction, Winston Churchill wrote afterwards, "No part of the Great War compares in interest with its opening. The measured, silent drawing together of gigantic forces, the uncertainty of their movements and positions, the number of unknown and unknowable facts made the first collision a drama never surpassed." And Max Hastings is able to take those first collisions and show them in their extremities in terms of the numbers of people, the desperation of the fighting, the impact on people in the surrounding area, the impact on animals. This is one of the first wars where animals were confiscated all over Europe and still used in large degree alongside automobiles and alongside airplanes. But the animals took the brunt of the war along with the human beings. And some of the letters are they start out so heroic. Young men have this idea that they're told it'll be over in a month. They have no idea that by the end of 1914, they're looking at four more years. And already they're depleted in every direction. So this is a profound piece of work that Max Hastings has done. I highly recommend him, only because I just think he's wonderful anyway, and so accessible for any kind of reader. The other book I brought on the subject is another book called July 1914, Countdown to War by Sean McMeekin. The author is an assistant professor of history at a Baltic university and author of other books on World War II, including, now here's the other side of the equation, a book called The Russian Origins of the First World War, and he lives in Istanbul. And the advantage of this book is that there's an awful lot of people in play. There's a huge politics here and major countries, many countries. And he writes that, and including Eastern countries, Japan is involved in this war with Russia. And there's just a lot going on here. He lists the dramatis personae at the beginning of the book, which I think is very helpful. It's like reading War and Peace without having a list of the characters. But he's done this for each country and all the fighting groups. So that's Austria, Hungary, Belgium, France, Germany, Great Britain, Russia, and Serbia. And he also offers a chronology, which I think is very helpful too, because this war is going on in a half a dozen different places, as with World War II, where you have three, four, five different fronts going on and events in those fronts. And only after a certain long period of time do you get some kind of summation of what's happening. So anyway, big topic next year. Expect to hear a lot about it.
Jill. Okay, I've got a book called Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World by James Lacy and Williamson Murray. And this is actually an update of a book that came out originally in 1851 called The 15 Decisive Battles of the World. We've now gotten up to 20 clashes. And I love the opening of this, the introduction here where they say, They quote Leon Trotsky, one of the more competent practitioners of the art of war, is reputed to have commented that, quote, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you."
So,
which I think is a really good point there. And it goes on to say, in other words, battles, wars, generals, and statesmen are simply the colorful but materially insignificant blips on the radar screen of any serious analysis of historical change. Yet it is the contention of the authors of this volume, who have seen war all too closely, that wars and battles have had a direct and massive impact on the course of history, one that is essential to understanding the world in which we live. We suspect the reader may agree with us. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this is it goes all the way up to 2003. The Drive for Baghdad is, in fact, their last piece in the moment of battle, the 20 clashes that changed the world, which I think is interesting that it is already becoming part of the canon, that particular event. And it's really, if you know nothing about any of these battles, this is a great place to start because you get just a little bit. You've got the Spanish Armada, you've got Vicksburg, you've got the Battle of Britain, Midway, all the classics, as it were, but in a sort of nice, manageable chapter.
Yep. Anything else in history for you?
I do have one other book that I brought with me called Agent Garbo, the brilliant, eccentric secret agent who tricked Hitler and saved D-Day, by Stephen Talty. And this actually was a book that our book club, our nonfiction book club, just read, and people really love this. Agent Garbo was a double agent for both the English and Germans. Garbo, a Spaniard whose real name was Juan Pujol Garcia, was a complex and interesting person with an unusual combination of being an ardent pacifist and wanting to fight against Hitler to save countless lives of people to which he had no connection. He did this with his gift of being a terrific actor with a fantastic imagination. He started by thinking like a German and determining what they wanted to know and how they wanted to receive information. Then he created this flamboyant, charismatic character for himself and a large network of fictitious sub-agents. The Germans had such faith in Garbo, whom they codenamed Arabelle, that they kept their forces in Calais and even diverted one unit to Calais that was en route to the attack at Normandy, based on his highly regarded intelligence. And they also, within the book group, they were talking about comparing the intelligence agencies from both countries and the tools of the spying trade. And none of them had read a nonfiction book about spies before and were surprised to learn about the complexity of being a double agent and the commitment it demanded of the spies as well as their families. Mm-hmm. So a really interesting story about Agent Garbo.
Yeah. I'm going to add two more actually to the list. And of course, Nat Philbrick, since you mentioned battle, his latest book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, of course, a fabulous read. And what's interesting is, and I'm reading now from his website, he finds new characters, new facets to familiar ones, which is so true. So we get some things that we hadn't known about before. And you've read it too.
Well, I have, and I thought Bunker Hill I'd been hearing about since I was a kid, right. But and had tried to read read other books on Bunker Hill, but I had to say that Nat Philbrick's was probably the best one I'd ever read on the topic. Yeah. The detail, but also the geographical placement of people.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people who will look at the maps and study them on my Nook. I enlarge them to just get a general sense of. I know Jill's laughing at me, but it's true, to get a general sense of where people are placed.
Yeah. Because, I look at the maps too. I don't put them up but I do look at the maps.
Yeah.
You gotta, maps are good.
Maps are good.
and I'm going to mention a couple of his other books because they were good. The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and The Battle of Little Bighorn. When I picked that book up, I thought I was going to be really interested in Sitting Bull more than Custer. Custer was a really kind of strange guy. That was a really interesting read. And then, of course, Mayflower was another. So we add those to the list.
Well, I'd like to mention Jill was talking about this book about important battles, and I found a book from 1999 that's sort of the flip side of that. It's called What If? The World's Foremost Military Historians Imagine What Might Have Been, and it includes essays by Stephen Ambrose, John Keegan, David McCullough, James McPherson, and a variety of others. But the interesting thing is they go back and they write about major battles in human history and what would have happened if they had turned. So, for example, you get... You get Alexander the Great dying young. You get the Romans conquering Germany instead of the other way around. You get the Mongols conquering Europe. You get the Spanish invasion of England, which, of course, we know the Armada kept that at bay. The British victory in New York. George Washington trapped forever in Brooklyn Heights. And the consequence of a German victory. Two Chinas on the mainland, a variety of different ways. So when we look at some of these things, we know that war, regardless of the outcome, has far-reaching consequences down through history. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I have not read this book, but I think I might pick it up just to see what some of these unusual turnabouts would have meant, right. Even to us as Americans.
Right. Janet is giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. I have a book to suggest. It's called The Last of the Doughboys, Doughboys, by Richard Rubin. And it's an excellent book. I bought it up here in the bookstore. And I'm particularly interested in it because in Chapter 3 and in other places, my father is interviewed, and he came out here, Richard Rubin, to interview Dad and enjoyed it, he said. And so I have the book, and it's not only about the forgotten soldiers who served in the World War I, but in the front it has different fighting. It's also about the war itself. So I just wanted to suggest The Last of the Doughboys.
Yeah, no, Janet, thank you for that. So we'll put that on our list. And for people going, all right, I got to write these books down. Remember, we will post the list. I'll link to it up on the website.
Oh, how nice.
Thanks, Janet, for adding that to our list. We appreciate
that.
Thank you. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Kathy in Sagamore says she wants to plug two titles here. Dana Reinhart's The Things a Brother Knows, contemporary coming home story of an older brother returning from the Iraq War and how it affects his younger brother and family. And she says that Dana is an amazingly good author. Michael Morpurgo's Private Peaceful, World War I story of what happens to the young men who make choices to defy the ruling class of the British Army. Tender and shocking of how war affects these in the trenches. Stunning and unforgettable tragedy told in tender but vivid writing. Kathy, thanks so much for adding
I think one of the things that one lady called the point is these people are not very far away from us. And I know my grandmother and grandfather used to talk about seeing the doughboys march through the streets of their little village in southern Ohio on their way off to war. Mm. And they were children at the time, but they had very strong recollections of that. And of course, the final point of all of that was the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918 when the doughboys came back and they brought these things and they were housed in close quarters and it spread. And that also was a major factor in their childhoods. People in all communities suffered from this. And so this war is bookended, I think, I think we can pick up those feelings from 100 years ago, even just through family.
Anything left in history?
I do. One more. I have Masters of the Battlefield, Great Commanders from the Classical Age to the Napoleonic Era by Paul K. Davis, who's an independent scholar and also the author of a book called 100 Decisive Battles. This is a new book. And it begins in 418 BC and runs through the mid-19th century, so you got a lot of reading ahead of you. Mm-hmm. Hundreds and hundreds of pages of Alexander the Great, Hannibal. These are all names we know. So these people have been remembered down through history. Alexander the Great, Hannibal, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, Frederick the Great, Napoleon, Duke of Wellington. These are all names we know. So these people's exploits, the battles they fought, even if they're not part of our lives or part of our history, are still part of world history. They were changes that were wrought sometimes in small places where very decisive battles happen, determining an entire people's freedom. So we also have to talk about why people go to war, and what sometimes comes out of it, both I hate to put it this way, but in the positive and also in the negative.
Yeah. We're talking with Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. We're talking about books on war. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Barbara is giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi. I could go on and on about World War One, Pat Barker, Paul Fussell, but I wanted to mention a book that I think many people may not know about. It's called Back to the Front, An Accidental Historian Walks the Trenches of World War One, and the author is Stephen O'Shea. It's not a new book. It was published in 2001, but my son, who is an aficionado of World War One, and I went to France and Belgium and followed this book, which isn't really meant as a guidebook, but it works, and visited all of the battlefields of World War One. O'Shea did it on foot. We did it by car. It's wonderful. It gives you an incredible sense of the terrain on which this horrible war was fought, and I recommend it highly.
Yeah, Barbara, what is it about World War One that attracted you, that you were so interested that you actually traveled to make this trip?
Well, it started because my son, who at the time was in high school, was so interested in it. His interest was in the military history. For me, Paul Fussell's book, The Great War and Modern Memory, which talks about how World War One changed everything about culture, literature, society, appealed to me as an English major. So it was a great mother teenage son trip.
Absolutely, yeah. Sounds like it was fantastic. Barbara, thank you for calling in and suggesting that. We'll add that to our list.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to add a book to our list of war books. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What do we got next?
I've got some novels.
Novels.
I can't go without having any novels. And one of the novels I brought has just come out. It's called Nostalgia by Dennis McFarland. And I can also tell you that Dennis McFarland will, in fact, be at the Falmouth Public Library tonight at 6:30. So I know you will all be preparing for watching the Red Sox. But the good thing about this novel, may I just say, is that the main character is not only a 19-year-old going to war, but he also plays baseball. So it's the perfect novel and the perfect writer to hear speak just before the game. And one of the little bits in here, which is really lovely, is talking about the ball and what they were using to make a ball. And the soldiers were playing with these balls. And it says, the chaplain, a sanguine, bespectacled fellow from Yonkers, manufactured 5 very fine, if lively, baseballs. And baseballs is 2 words, you know, baseballs, by cutting strips of rubber from old overshoes, boiling the strips till they grew gummy and could be formed into small spheres, then wrapping these with yarn and covering them with horsehide. Soldiers whittled a number of bats from a variety of woods and in a variety of lengths and shapes. They found no entirely suitable plot of ground, though the patch they settled on was acceptable, but for an alarming downward dip in the center field. The seat of a wooden chair with legs and back removed was employed as the home base, and haversacks filled with sawdust served as the 3 others. The practices comprised as much argument as they did physical exercise, and Hayes, young, new, and untested in battle, found himself at the awkward post of arbiter. So just that sort of image of how they were playing baseball is really fabulous. And in the review of this, it talks about how emotionally harrowing this Civil War novel is. Summerfield Hayes is a 19-year-old Brooklynite living on Hicks Street and pitching for one of the local baseball teams. Over the objections of his older sister, Hayes enlists in the Union Army and ends up taking part in the Battle of the Wilderness. Wounded, he winds up in a hospital in Washington City, where his doctors see that the horrors of battle have rendered him mute and incapable of even signing his own name, and diagnose him as suffering from a medical condition then called nostalgia. Hayes is cared for by, among others, a ward matron and a bearded hospital volunteer named Walt, whose identity should be immediately apparent to anyone who knows anything about 19th century American poets.
Aww.
So you get a little Walt in here, yeah, along with your baseball. What more could you ask for?
Right. Yeah.
And again, Dennis will be at the Falmouth Public Library tonight at 6:30, so that should be, yeah, really interesting.
And you've got one more novel?
Well, I had to bring with me my first war novel ever that I ever read and sticks with me still, and that is the amazing thing about great books. Right. They do stick with you. I have brought Johnny Tremaine, A Story of Boston in Revolt,
wow,
by Esther Forbes. It's just such a good story. And of course, it's set, you know, mm-hmm, it's Boston. And one of the things I learned the moment I can still remember, sort of these shivers down my back, that moment where, for those of you that may not have read Johnny Tremaine when you were young, is on page 33 when he burns his hand. He moved forward delicately, his right hand outstretched. The crucible began to settle, collapse. The silver was running over the top of the furnace like spilled milk. Johnny jumped toward it, his right hand still outstretched. Something happened. He never knew exactly what. His feet went out from under him. His hand came down on the top of the furnace. The burn was so terrible, he at first felt no pain, but stood stupidly looking at his hand. For 1 second before the metal cooled, the inside of his right hand, from wrist to fingertips, was coated with solid silver.
Ugh.
He looked at the back of his hand. It was as always. Then he smelled burned flesh. The room blackened and tipped around him. He heard a roaring in his ears.
You're shaking your hand.
What's that? It's so awful.
And
this is a kid's book, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh, it's a powerful read for a young person.
Yeah, it is really something. And it spans his life, the life of Johnny Tremaine, who is an orphan and a silversmith. And, you know, what good children's book that is the main character not an orphan? You've got to get rid of the parents in order to have an adventure. An orphan and a silversmith apprentice. While casting a sugar basin for John Hancock, he burns his right hand and must abandon his position. But he finds work as a messenger for the Sons of Liberty, becoming swept up in the American Revolution. And Anita Silvey, whose stuff I like very much and talks about this book in her Book a Day Almanac, says that one of the great things about this is that Forbes brought an amazing amount of historical detail to life and brings young readers behind the scenes as the colonists decide to rebel against the British. As the New York Times said of her, she was, quote, a novelist who wrote like a historian and a historian who wrote like a novelist.
The ultimate praise.
You know, when you said that was the first, you know, war book that you read, as a kid, mine, I think, was Diary of Anne Frank.
This would have been Diary of Anne Frank.
I didn't read that one.
Diary
of Anne Frank, that's another.
That would have been, for me, that was like mid-elementary school. Mm. And I think, to tell you the truth, I think Disney made a movie out of it, too, that I probably, you know, was rapt over.
Right.
But, in talking about the novels, when I looked at the Goodreads list, I realized I had read a lot of them. But I think that war writing is often the jumping off point for a lot of our best writers. And in the 19th century, Stephen Crane made his debut and also his name on Red Badge of Courage. Mm. Ambrose Bierce, too. These were strong contenders for these roles. And then you get in the 20th century and you've got people like Norman Mailer, whose first novel was The Naked and the Dead, and about World War II, and Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut, mm-hmm, all veterans whose first novels were all very much about the absurdity of war. And we see that now later on, too, where we have Tim O'Brien, people like that, who are still telling us what war is about. And I'm sure, well, I'm not sure how many of the novels have come out. But for example, The Yellow Birds, which won, I believe, a National Book Award last year. I can't remember which award it was, but that's a book out of Iraq. And so those people are starting to come back from war and start to write their fiction.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned that, this is not fiction, but of course, Sebastian Younger's book, War, which,
right,
I mean, that was a fabulous.
It is.
You know, I mean, this is where he goes in with these soldiers in the Coringell Valley. And these guys are seeing up to a dozen or more firefights every single day.
Right.
That was just an amazing look at, you know, the reality of war.
Yeah. And also the reality of Afghanistan.
Of Afghanistan,
That if you think that you know what's happening in Afghanistan, you need to read a book like that that
to
gives
you
both
the background
and the geography of the place. play. So we're really not, we're not putting soldiers in the context with other soldiers. Yeah. We're putting a small group of people in an almost inaccessible place, mm-hmm. and we're saying, defend it.
Well, you know what's interesting too there is when they talked about recruiting, how they would recruit some of the soldiers, they would have, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and on these rocks you'd see somebody's cell phone painted, you know, like call this number. Yeah. You know, it's just amazing.
I know, it is. Yeah. It absolutely is.
It was an amazing book, so that's another one to add to the list.
Absolutely. And the way people write novels, I mean, the entire sense of what a novel is between, you know, War and Peace and Catch-22, right. and then and the newer novels and people's response to war is just so different mm-hmm. as time passes on.
Yep. And the novelist uses what is contemporary for him or her in that particular war. So as you're reading along, you get your realism, you get your surrealism. And for example, I just recently read Tim O'Brien's Going After Cacciato for the first time and found it just as fresh and just as engaging as it would have been back in the early 70s when the book was first written and became, again, it won the National Book yeah. Award. And Tim O'Brien is still writing. He wrote another famous book called The Things They Carried,
right.
Which I think between the two of those are sort of the Vietnam novels.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about books on war. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. Kathy is calling from Sagamore. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I'm here.
Good. What have you got? What do you got for us, Kathy?
Oh, it's just one more book. It's mm-hmm. a young adult book. It's called Codename Verity. It is a World War II book, but it's about the young woman who actually helped the French resistance and dropped off British soldiers and quote-unquote spies into behind enemy lines. It's a wonderful book. It's amazing to listen to as a recorded book. It's Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine, I think, is the correct way to pronounce her name. And that's it. And thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Johnny Tremaine.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. Rob is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Lori Lee is a writer barely known in this country, but extremely famous in the rest of the English-speaking world. His first memoir, Cider with Rosie, is on the O-Levels reading list in England. His second memoir, As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, takes him into the Spanish Civil War. And the third volume, A Moment of War, is all about the Spanish Civil War. Mm. It was reviewed in the New York Times by Verlin Klinkenborg, and I think it's the best book on war I've ever read.
Oh, wow.
It's only about 160 pages long, published by Penguin.
Yeah. And you were not in your health care.
These books, I worked many years ago at the Boston Athenaeum, and Cider with Rosie was just like a huge hit when that came out. I still recall. It was very, very popular when it came out, and great book.
Yeah. Rob, thanks for those suggestions. Those are good ones. We'll put that on our list. Thanks for calling in. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to add to our list of books on war. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeendislands.org. Melanie, you've got a couple books there on weaponry.
I do. And it's not my favorite area, but it is, you know, I mean, it's how we wage war. But I went a little bit on the outside here, and I found this book from 2012 called Straight and True, A Select History of the Arrow by Hugh D.H. Soar, S-O-A-R. And the author, Mr. Soar, is one of the world's leading experts on the history of archery. Hmm. And giving him his due, I mean, we need one, and I guess he is it. And he's interested specifically in the design and use of the longbow. And to think about that, we kind of have to go back, way back, and to the English wars back in the medieval era, and also I'm sure European wars too, for the power of the bow. When we watch a movie like, I'll think of it. Anyway, you see the long rows of men with bows. The mm-hmm. archers are brought up for a certain kind of intermediate distance warfare. It's not hand to hand and it's not artillery. It's that mm-hmm. middle ground where they measure the ability of the bow, the arrow to capture. That's where the shield comes from too. Mm-hmm. It's this ability to sort of wage war over an open piece of ground. And he writes in his introduction, subordinate to the bow, its charismatic companion, opinion, but purposeful in its intent. The Arrow epitomizes both silent death and joyous recreation. That's a sentence right there. With origins lost in time, it is obedient to all who use it, but respectful of none. It is synonymous with both the wayward vagaries of Cupid and the esoteric practices of a divining shaman. It is equally at home in the quiver of Artemis the Huntress, in the hands of a formidable English or Welsh bowman on the bloody medieval battlefield, or those of a beguiling Victorian maiden on a dew-soaked vicarage lawn.
Which is absolutely, I have to just interrupt to say, right now, reading Daniel Deronda, the whole thing is about archery. There's a chapter after chapter about archery.
Right. It has a greater meaning than it itself. Although it is a means of simple pleasure, it has a dark side too, since it was the instrument and symbol of their martyrdom for Saint Edmund, King of Saxon East Anglia, Saint Sebastian of Milan, and Saint Ursula of Cologne. Whether fashioned from man-made or natural materials, each shaft relies ultimately upon the skill of its creator, its various profiles adopted for purpose, with each supple shape the product of trial and error by arrow makers across the centuries. And so this book goes into the making of, the handling of, and the use of arrows from Asia, India, and the Tudor period, how royal patrons would hire people to make arrows specific to their instructions and their specs. And there are pictures, many, many pictures. Again, I think you got to be interested in this to go in there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you've always been interested in that type of warfare or seen it in movies or whatever, this would be a good way to learn more. The second book I found is a book called The Amazing Weapons That Never Were, Robots, Flying Tanks, and Other Machines of War by Gregory Benford and the editors of Popular Mechanics magazine. This came out last year, and the author is a physics professor and two-time Nebula Award winner, which is for science fiction. It's full of flashy, colorful photos. It talks about how people imagined future wars would be fought, computerization, air war, ground sea transport, television, which was only imagined at one time, what role it might have, and atomic power, and all kinds of machines that people had on drawing boards but were never built. And I think for some of these, we got to be grateful for that.
For sure. You have a kid's book that has something to do with a weapon.
I do indeed. And it's called Henry and the Cannons by Don Brown. And I have to say, you know, we've talked before about micro histories, but I have never before seen a picture book that was a micro history, which is essentially what this is. It's about this one episode having to do with Henry Knox. In the winter of 1775, the British Army occupied Boston, with George Washington and his troops were relegated to the surrounding hills. The general, quote, ached for cannons. With them, he could rain cannonballs on the British soldiers' heads and drive them from Boston. And an unlikely hero emerges, Henry Knox, a bookseller who travels 300 miles to Fort Ticonderoga to acquire 59 cannons. And so, and in this story, which begins, which is really sweet, it begins, it was the winter of 1775. The American Revolution had begun, and things weren't going well for the Patriots of Boston, Massachusetts. The British Army held the city. They thumbed their noses at the surrounding hills where General George Washington and his soldiers stared down at them. And it seriously is just the story about him going to get the cannons and bringing them back. And he has to go through many arduous things in order to bring the cannons back. And he has a group of men that go with him. And then by the end, of course, they are, they save the day. They've got the cannons. And it's really sort of funny that I ran across this book, because I used to, when I was working at the Athenaeum, I used to sit right across from the Knox Library. I knew nothing about this story. They have like 500 books that used to belong to Henry Knox that they purchased in 1809. And I was like, I can't believe that I didn't know this story before now, that it took me this long to learn the story of Henry Knox and the cannons.
And you have a children's
book? I have a book called The Civil War for Kids, A History with 21 Activities. And there's a lot of children's books on war. This book came out in 1999. It's part of a series that also includes Underground Railroad, Lewis and Clark, American Revolution, etc. And it's full of activities. It's got the background on a variety of different people from the beginning of the war to the end. But there are activities for children. For example, they can learn and play Civil War era games. They can practice their rebel yell. They can build a lean-to. They can make a drum out of a coffee can. And the topics that are included include things like drilling, military drilling, camp life, hardships of war, technology, engineering, photography, and then also in the back, how to play taps and what taps means. And so the book, I think, would be an excellent starting point for, say, a 10, 11, 12-year-old, something like that. And yet they would also come away with a lot of history. I also found another book, brand new, called Profiles. It's a series called Profiles, One Event, Six Bios. And this one is of the Vietnam War. It's loaded with photos, has a timeline, a glossary, and a bibliography. And it's six profiles of people like Henry Kissinger, William Westmoreland, General William Westmoreland, Lyndon B. Johnson, Ho Chi Minh, John F. Kennedy, and Ngo Dinh Diem. Mm. And these are the major players in that period. And it just profiles them and their role. And then there's an introduction. So I think if some child said to you, gee, what was that all about? This would be a good place to go, this series.
You have more children's?
I do have a couple children's. And one of them, I think it is only good to talk about the other side of war. This one is called Why War is Never a Good Idea by Alice Walker. It is a picture book. And I'm somewhat confused as to what age this would be, because it seems like it would be really, while it's a picture book, it seems like it would be really hard and scary for a lot of small children. But it begins very beautifully. The war speaks every language. It never knows what to say to frogs. Picture frogs beside a pond holding their annual pre-rainy season convention. They do not see war, huge tires of a camouflaged vehicle about to squash them flat.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I don't know what age exactly this was. They claim it was for young children, but I think it could be really.
Maybe, yeah.
And here's another little bit of this. And because it's Alice Walker writing, and it's lovely. War has bad manners. War eats everything in its path. And what it doesn't eat, it dribbles on. Here, war is munching on a village, its missiles taking chunks, big bites out of it. War's leftover gunk seeps like saliva into the ground. It is finding the way into the village well. So, a very curious picture book. I mean, I think it is a really interesting message that it's trying to get across, but...
Yeah, got to be careful. And then you've got...
And I also brought with me Dogs on Duty.
I like that
Soldiers'
one.
Best Friends on the Battlefield and Beyond. And I discovered my new acronym here, MWD, is for Military Working Dogs. And this does the history of dogs in the military.
Great
from,
photos.
You know, World War One hero hound Stubby. And it goes right through. And Stubby was the most famous American war dog of World War One, but now, as of late 2011, United States forces had 2,700 dogs on active duty, which is a lot of dogs.
That is a lot of dogs.
Anyway, they talk about all the different wars dogs have been part of. They have great photos, how dogs become military working dogs, and a really interesting read for kids.
All right. Liz in Woods Hole writes in on an email, listening now, would love to recommend Ian Toll's Six Frigates, which is about the foundation of the U.S. Navy. While the eyes of the world watch the fledgling republic with all expectation of failure, the founders pieced together an American Navy, which includes the USS Constitution. It's a fascinating look at the obstacles faced by the early republic, from the nuts and bolts of actually building the vessels, the politics of naming the shipyard locations, and in my view, an especially insightful look at America's initial relations with the Muslim world during the Barbary Wars. It's written in a way that engages all types of readers, from academics to couch-by-the-fire relaxers. Enjoy. Thanks, Liz, for that.
Oh, I like that. Couch-by-the-fire relaxers.
Exactly. We only have a few minutes left, but one of the things that since we've got all this, you did bring some anti-war books.
I did. And actually, one of the books, both that picture book, but I also brought along with me Cry Out, Poets Protest the War. There is a lot of poetry that is out there about how war is not a good thing. And there is a great poem. This was a collection that was put together after Laura Bush in 2003 had invited poets to attend this White House event honoring Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson and Langston Hughes. But word got out that they might not be so pro-war. So they got disinvited. invited.
Oh, no.
But they ended up having an event anyway in Manchester, Vermont. And there were 11 poets, including Grace Paley, Donald Hall, Ruth Stone, Galway Connell. Here's one little poem by Jane Kenyon called Three Small Oranges. My old flannel nightgown, the elbows out, one shoulder torn. Instead of putting it away with a clean wash, I cut it up for rags, removing the arms and opening their seams, scissoring across the breast and upper back, then tearing the thin cloth of the body into long rectangles. Suddenly, an immense sadness. Making supper, I listen to news from the war of torture, where the air is black at noon with burning oil, and of a market in Baghdad bombed by accident, where yesterday an old man carried in his basket a piece of fish wrapped in paper and tied with string, and three small, hard green oranges.
Mm. Wow.
Great poems, great collection.
Yeah. What have you got?
Well, how much time do we have?
We have about 2-3 minutes.
Okay. I did bring two books on war trends. One is called Concrete Hell, Urban Warfare from Stalingrad to Iraq by Louis DeMarco. It talks about how in the last century, the trend has been away from wars fought on battlefields and instead fought in urban centers, which I think we're increasingly seeing. Of course, we know that from World War II. And a second book called Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield by Jeremy Scahill, who wrote a best-selling book called Blackwater. He's a contemporary journalist, and he suggests now that we are going into a period of covert but constant war. And the rise of mercenary armies, mercenary fighters from every country, including our own, and that we are hiring them as sort of a, hey, we'll pay you to go fight this war. But that war is probably going to be low level and unending from this point for a good time to come. And then the final book that I brought is, of course, with every end of war, there's reckoning. And this is a new book, and this is probably going to be one of my next reads. It's called Hans and Rudolf, the true story of the German Jew who tracked down and caught the commandant of Auschwitz. And it's by Thomas Harding. And this book is brand new. And I started reading the first couple of pages of it and realized that I couldn't commit at the moment. Right. So I promptly closed it. But apparently, Thomas Harding was a relative and who never spoke about this. And only when he died and his obituary was written did the family come out and start talking about the fact that he had chased this man down.
About 30 seconds, Jill.
I just want to say, if you have never read Virginia Woolf's Three Guineas, which is a great anti-war essay, part novel, part essay, you should definitely read it. It's about war. It's about how to prevent war, about how to maintain peace, about all of the crazy things that happen with women and men and how difficult it is for people to understand one another, and also how photography is also involved, because it involves the images of war as well. Really fabulous essays.
All right, and we'll have a list, a link to the book list on our website, capeandislands.org. Look in the programs tab and hit on the point. We'll have that list there. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times. As always, thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.